Welcome to Board Game Workshop. I'm your host, Chris Anderson. This episode is part of a five-part series with Jeff Warrender discussing topics in his new book, You Said This Would Be Fun. The book is available in paperback, Kindle, and EPUB versions on Amazon and DriveThruRPG. Go to the show notes for this episode at theboardgameworkshop.com for links. The Board Game Workshop Design Contest is currently accepting submissions and judges. Submissions are due by June 5th. Go to theboardgameworkshop.com for details. That's all. Now on to the show.
This is the fifth and final episode in this five-part series in which we're looking over ideas discussed in You Said This Would Be Fun to learn what makes a game good and how to make a good game. In our first episode, we established several axioms of good design and used these to build three pillars of player-centered design: engagement, motivation, and challenge. In this last part, we will talk about the step that tells you how close your best efforts to implement these principles have come, the process of playtesting. Of course, playtesting doesn't happen only at the last stage of the design. It's been happening throughout the entire design process. But playtesting comes at the end of my book and at the end of this series because I think that understanding what good design is supposed to entail in the first place helps us to think about how we should go about our playtesting as well. Let me explain by illustrating two approaches to playtesting that I think are ultimately ineffective. The first is expressed in oft-heard conventional wisdom that advises designers, playtest, 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 keep playtesting, and after you playtest some more. Of course, playtesting is good, but just counting up playtesting and trying to make that number as big as possible isn't good technique, because not all playtests are equally useful or productive, and so playtesting just for the sake of playtesting can often be a waste of everyone's time. Relatedly, there's the spaghetti at the wall approach to playtesting, which is to say we play the game and then I make some changes to it and then we play again and then I make some more changes and we keep doing that and each time we're seeing whether the group likes it better. This approach to testing, I think, has two problems. First, it ignores the advice of the previous three episodes, the most significant of which is to have some idea of what the game is trying to do, what it's trying to express. Lacking even some approximation of this, you don't know what your design is aiming for, and you won't know how to find it. And second, and relatedly, it makes the approval of the playtesters the center of gravity for the design. If they seem to like the game, keep going in whatever direction it's going. But if not, maybe change some things. But this is a terrible way to design. It's akin to driving by having passengers in your car randomly shout out directions. Turn left, now right, now left again. You'll probably end up somewhere in the end, but the likelihood of it being where you intended to go is pretty small. This is emphatically not to denigrate the contribution of playtesters. They're invaluable to our ability to make good games, and they receive paltry compensation for their efforts. But most are willing to do it because they enjoy being a part of the process. Most of all, they want to be afforded some input. They want to feel that they contributed something. And for this reason, you must always treat them with the utmost of respect. And that means listening to whatever they have to say, not shouting it down or arguing with it, just listening to whatever it is. And this isn't just a matter of patronizing your playtesters. You must listen because sometimes they're right. You never know where a good suggestion will come from, and I've seen and had it happen myself where a player catches a better vision for what your game is trying to be than what you yourself had. Nothing says you have to use every idea that playtesters provide. The preceding discussion emphatically states you should not. But you should at least hear them out, hear what they have to say. Now, in the limited time allotted to us, we don't have the ability to cover so expansive a topic as playtesting, and it certainly isn't our aim to go through all of the nuts and bolts of how to playtest. What I instead want to focus on are two concepts in playtesting that relate to reacting effectively to playtester feedback. How do we deal with confusion, and how do we streamline a game that's overly complex? And certainly these are two common problems to find yourself having to deal with. Confusion often arises, we must say, from an obvious source. The game has been taught poorly. Lots of game players just aren't very good at teaching games, and designers are rarely exempt from this, even including teaching their own games. So it's certainly not uncommon to just confuse your players because you've taught the game poorly, and there are ways to deal with that include things like just practicing and trying to get better at your technique. But Another source of confusion can come from the unwitting confusion of a player who believes himself to have discovered some flaw in your game, something that's too powerful, a board state that's broken, whatever. And sometimes that person is right, and so you should listen. But sometimes they're not, and you're pretty sure that they're not, but it's pretty clear that they feel very strongly about their position, and we need to stop the session and support and sort things out. So the way I usually try to handle that situation is to try to lay out all of the person's options, including ones that they may not have considered, and point out the pros and cons of each, kind of like what we talked about in the last episode. The point isn't to tell the player what they should be doing, but to clarify what they're deciding between, and having clarity here might change their perspective about there being a clear best play. In other cases, the Socratic method can work well. In others, still, it's useful to remember that just as games tell stories, the act of creating a game produces stories. And you can use anecdotes from sessions past to suggest, for example, you know, you're saying this card is almost useless, but actually it turned out to be really pivotal in this one game, and you can tell them the story of how that happened. Sometimes, though, confusion isn't something that you can resolve just by patiently explaining the rules again, or working through an example, because sometimes it reflects something genuinely flawed about the game. But sometimes you have to read between the lines a bit to decipher just what that something is. Sometimes a player is just unable to figure out what they're supposed to be doing on their turn. Think about a simple game like Carcassonne. Few players find this turn mechanic confusing because the structure is so simple. You draw a tile, you place it, and then you put a piece on it, or you don't. On the other hand, a game like Puerto Rico has quite a few things you're allowed to do on your turn, but each makes intuitive sense, and, making it even easier, they fit together in a loop. So settler gives you plantations, mayor gives you colonists, craftsman produces resources from your plantations, trader lets you sell those resources, builder lets you build stuff with the money you've raised. And note that it's easy to state in plain language what I'm doing as the player. Even if when I'm learning, I don't necessarily understand the game mechanical implementation of everything I'm allowed to do, I can at least intuitively understand, the captain means I put goods on ships and I'm going to get points for it. If there are too many things your players can potentially do, or if the things that they can do are convoluted and they can't say in a simple way what they're doing, it may mean that the turn mechanic, however snappy it may be, isn't fulfilling its role. Because again, the turn mechanic is supposed to be the interface to the game, and it should be unobtrusive. It's like a window that you can see through clearly to the game behind it, namely the scoring system and the contest against my opponents. Sometimes, though, that even the concept of victory is itself hard to see clearly. In many cases, a similar root cause is to blame. The players can't say in simple words what the scoring system represents. This is especially true in games that bestow victory points from a wide variety of sources. It's less clear what those points mean the more ways there are to get them, and the more gamey a goal is, the less sense it will make to pursue it. So here I tend to advise making this more wooden rather than less. If I'm a business owner, I don't want to open 4 businesses in each of 5 different towns, and I don't want to secure the best advertising locations, I just want to make money. And simplifying the goal has the benefit of clarifying that goal, and all those other effects should arise as emergent effects of the scoring system. Of course, a convoluted goal isn't the only form that overwrought complexity can take. Many games, especially early in the process, exhibit excessive complexity, and this distracts the player from the interesting moments of friction. For this reason, a game in that state may require a cycle or several cycles of streamlining. And when we talk about streamlining, this is usually a target-rich environment, and we want to know where to aim our sledgehammers of streamlining so we know what to remove. One of the first places I look is at rules that I'm embarrassed to have to explain. Maybe I've just taught you the core turn mechanic and you're nodding along in comprehension, but now I have to explain some fiddly exception and I know it's going to frustrate you when I do. And when I find myself cringing as I'm about to explain some rule, that's often a sign that that particular rule may be more trouble than it's worth. And it's definitely worth at least playtesting it without that rule at least once or twice and see whether it hurt things. And usually what happens is no one even notices that you took away that rule. So it often ends up being a rule you can cut out. Second, I've learned the hard way that there are rules that have been preserved across many versions, but stopped serving a useful purpose many iterations ago because the situation they were introduced to address no longer happens or no longer applies. And I'll give an example from my Civilization game, Sands of Time. In an early version, you counted up your production from all of your pieces at the start of each round, but because of some peculiarities of the board layout, this was tedious and very time-consuming. So to reduce the number of times you had to do it, we added a rule that let you use a track to keep track of your production, and you would only change your positions on the track, on the production track, when a census event happens. Well, then we did away with events, and so now we needed a new trigger to update your production, and so we were thinking about what that ought to be. And one of the players said, why do we need to track our production? Why don't we just count it up at the start of the round? And sure enough, other things had changed, and so the reason for the production tracks really no longer even applied to the game. We had just kept it because it had always been there, and we hadn't questioned up to that point why it was in there. Of course, in the process of streamlining, there are some things you should absolutely not streamline out, and playtester reactions can help you figure out what those are, the things that playtesters react most favorably to, the moments where they're most engaged, most invested. Watch for these and make sure not to cut those elements out. Yes, it's important to have a vision for what your game is trying to be, but sometimes the game gets to overrule you, and the playtester response to the game can show you when that needs to happen. As our axiom says, let the players do the fun thing. Don't cut the fun thing out, and if it's too clunky or convoluted, find ways to simplify or clarify it. There's, of course, plenty more to be said about playtesting, but it would seem that ending on the high note of letting players do the fun thing is a worthy final admonition for this series. We're seeking a game that delivers a fun and memorable experience, that will create fun stories that are new with each playing, and that players will want to participate in over and over because we've paid attention to detail and engaged, motivated, and challenged them. A game that does those things may not become a classic because it's a competitive market after all, but at least you've given it every chance to succeed. So I hope that this series has been entertaining and encouraging, and may we all be motivated to continue to strive for excellence in our own designs. When we do this, whether or not our game becomes a hit, the story of our game's creation, at least, has a happy ending, and it's been time well spent for those involved. So best of luck to you on your own design endeavors, and thank you for listening to this series. I'd like to thank Chris for hosting this on the Board Game Workshop podcast, and if you're interested in reading more, You Said This Would Be Fun is available at Amazon in Kindle and paperback, and at DriveThruRPG in EPUB. Look for an audiobook version later this year.
That's all for this episode. Financial support for the Board Game Workshop is provided by our annual game design contest and our Patreon supporters. Special thanks to our inventor-level supporters, Corey Muddiman, Roscoe Schock, Brad Batchelor, and Chris Turner. If you would like to support the show, go to patreon.com/theboardgameworkshop. You can contact the show on Twitter, Facebook, and Discord. Go to theboardgameworkshop.com for links, past episodes, and information about our design contest and other events. Thanks for listening!